Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories from the past, from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the Dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented, a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply by looking into one single person's family history, for example. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Approach with caution. Hello, and welcome to No Heathen Land. You're listening to Season 2, Episode 4. I had a little bit of a break from the podcast over the past few weeks, and no real reason, just time, logistics and such, but here I am, back again. This episode, I am really excited to welcome local history librarian in Leeds and my friend, Anthony Ram. Myself and Anthony worked together for years, and even though, as you'll hear, he kind of alludes to not knowing very much, he's a very experienced researcher and librarian who, as I also mentioned, I should have had on the podcast way sooner. The main thing I wanted to mention at the beginning of this episode is that unfortunately my trusty dictaphone died halfway through this recording, and I don't think the dictaphone is salvageable. This meant that halfway through our chat, I had to hastily download an app for my phone and record the rest on there, and it's glitchy. I now know why, but in the second half, there are glitches every so often, and I'm so sorry if it's distracting, and I'm more sorry to Anthony for the janked up audio in this episode. I did decide to keep the audio and not re-record because I think it would lose the atmosphere of the chat that we had, and I hope you agree, and this just means that I'll be having Anthony back on the podcast again soon, I really hope. So again, huge apologies, this episode is full of glitches in the second half, but I hope you get the gist of our conversation and enjoy hearing about the subject as much as I did. So I'll be back at the end as usual to say goodbye and share info on where to find out more. Thanks for being here. Here's Anthony Ram discussing the fascinating world of antiquarians. Right. Hi, Anthony.
Hello.
This is Anthony Ram. So Anthony is a librarian in Leeds, and that is how we met. So we used to work together. So I just wanted to ask what your involvement in local history is.
Right. Well, primarily... my work, my job, I'm a local, one of two local history librarians, or not two, one of two librarians for local and family history department at the Central Public Library in Leeds. But I'm also a member and a council member for the Thoresby Society, which is the main society that looks at local history in Leeds. I organise the society's lecture programme. So between those two things, that is my involvement in local history.
Yeah, and I do feel slightly bad because I feel like you should have been one of the first guests on the podcast, because I've had quite a few now, and when I first started the podcast, I did like email out to people that I knew and be like, do you want to be on my podcast? And you should have been on before, really, and I feel quite bad that I've left it for so long.
I think that's fine. I do remember, and I sort of said that I would be happy
you
to do it.
You felt very hurt.
No. I just honestly, hearing what other people have talked about, it's so much more interesting than what I would have to talk about.
That's absolutely not true.
Let's hope that that's not the case.
It's not the case, because Anthony is very experienced in local history, and I know that you know a lot of stuff. I've nearly knocked over some coffee. I know that you know a lot of stuff. And I think, especially in public librarianship and something that's like fairly specialist, like local history, I think everyone always feels a bit like they know very little, but about lots of things. And I think I said this before about the things that I feel like I know about. I feel like I've got like these little tiny snippets of information, but about loads of stuff.
Or you become an expert in something for like a really brief period of time. Yes. You spend ages looking at one thing in loads of detail, and then you never look at it ever again.
Oh, just, you know, there's something that comes up, which is a nice thing, that is really, really interesting. Like you do an inquiry for somebody and it's really fascinating. Or you get told a little story and then you find out everything about a person or something. I feel like maybe what you're going to be talking about today might have stemmed from something like that.
Yeah.
So, do you want to tell us what you are going to be talking about today? I'm quite excited about this.
Really? That's good to hear. So I'm going to be talking about antiquarians, specifically antiquarians in Leeds, really. And this has stemmed from stuff that I've come across in work, really, in some of the collections and things that we have at the Central Library. That's what's got me interested in antiquarians. I should preface all of this by giving credit to my colleague Philip Wilde, who has taught me tons and tons and tons about antiquarians in Leeds and our collection. So a lot of what I'm going to say I have got from Phil, but I've done bits and pieces of my own research. So yes, thank you very much, Phil.
I'm sure he'll not listen, but I'll tell him that you mentioned
it. I still need to know that I've credited him.
We'll be sure to let him know.
Yeah.
Probably should be credited with quite a lot of stuff, honest.
That is true. Yeah.
So, what is an antiquarian?
I'm glad you asked. I spent quite a bit of time trying to come up with a pithy definition, and the more time that I spent trying to get a pithy definition, the more I got myself tangled up in knots. As with many things, it can be quite a complicated subject, but I've come up with a kind of shortish description, which I've written down, which is that antiquarians were basically a kind of historian active from the 16th and 17th centuries who used physical artifacts of the past, things like monuments, inscriptions, coins, manuscripts — that's where our collections at the library come in, really — to uncover the facts of British history. And that thing about facts is really important, because the antiquarians are to be contrasted, really, with — and this, it gets a bit complicated here — but in their own time, in the 16th, 17th, even 18th centuries, what were called historians were very different from historians that we have, or quite different from historians that we have today. And in fact, antiquarians were closer to our modern day historians, and in fact archaeologists, in that they were trying to use primary sources to uncover or ascertain facts about the past, particularly the distant sort of ancient past, kind of Roman, Anglo-Saxon periods and Middle Ages, periods that were kind of shrouded in sort of myth and legend, and they were trying to use actual physical artefacts to pin down facts, whereas what were called historians at the time would often just be writing grand, broad, sort of sweeping narratives that were often based on kind of second-hand information. And really those narratives were designed to make political points that were relevant to their own times, rather than actually uncovering truths about the past, to the extent that you can uncover truths about the past.
That's so interesting.
So antiquarians were really, despite the fact that today the term is kind of used as an insult to mean someone who spends too much time being obsessed on kind of really small details about the past, they're actually very important kind of pioneering figures.
I see. So I think it is quite a cool name. This might be a stupid question. The word antique must have come before antiquarian.
That's surely a good point. I probably have read about this, but I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, probably, or at least the roots of
it. It conjures up in my mind a middle-aged white man sat at a big desk with lots of like stuff in front of him, and surrounded by trinkets.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the that is both partly the fact, but also definitely the myth, if that's the right word, of the antiquarian, or the sort of romantic image of the antiquarian.
I think that's probably what I'm thinking of. And I imagine that they were probably obsessive.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, absolutely. In both a good and a bad way, really, I suppose. I mean, that obsession would lead a lot of them to track down materials that were otherwise were just going to disappear or be lost. I mean, there's stories about, particularly the kind of very early generations in the 16th and 17th century, tracking down manuscripts and kind of state documents that were just languishing in like totally unsuitable conditions and would just would have just disappeared forever. So that obsession could be really helpful in that it's helped us preserve these materials, but at the same time, I was reading just today actually when I was doing bits of sort of preparation about the extent to which some antiquarians would collect so much material that it was just too much and they would never ever be able to marshal it together to actually do anything with it. And there was a guy, one of the very, very first antiquarians in Britain called John, I think it was John Leyland or Leland, and he reputedly went mad from
too much stuff.
Yeah, from too much stuff.
I feel like that's what I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Be surrounded by my things.
My
precious things.
Well, even that's a kind of slightly sort of romantic idea, isn't it? For librarians, you know, he's gone mad from all the books and information he's surrounded with.
You know, it made me think of, and I know, I hope this is going to sort of make everyone that's involved in this laugh, but it made me think of your office at work.
Yes.
So I went in the other day and it was like there was all these things that had appeared on the floor around various people's desks, all of which have also been on the podcast.
Yes.
And when we shared, when I was in the office with a couple of the librarians, when I was a local history librarian, we were always like hiding behind piles of photographs and books and things that we definitely should have put back weeks before, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So really we're just carrying on this like romantic idea of antiquarianism.
Yeah, antiquarians, we're just like modern day antiquarians.
Yeah, anyway, enough about us. this podcast is sort of focused on sort of like the stranger side of history, I guess, and I'm hoping that these chaps are eccentric.
Yeah, they are. They definitely are. I mean, you know, what we were just saying about some of the wilder, more extremes of behaviour that antiquarianism leads to. At the same time, some of these, the leads antiquarians, anyway, and the other thing I should say about antiquarians is that we're really pioneers in local history, which again is probably really where my interest in them has come from, in that. So they would write a lot about, or they'd collect a lot. A lot of the material they'd be looking at would be in their local area.
Mm-hmm.
So like church monuments and inscriptions and things like that.
Yeah.
So they were the very first people to take an interest in history in their local area.
Mm-hmm.
And they would write what are called county histories. So histories, obviously, of counties and of towns as well, as we'll come to when we get some of these. Some of these guys, so they're really important for that reason as well. But the Leeds antiquarians, in and of themselves, whether they are interesting enough, I don't know. But some of the stuff that they wrote, is weird. And I've
good.
This has given me an opportunity to do something that I've been meaning to for a while, which was to really look in quite a bit of detail at one book in particular and some of the stranger material that was in that book. So
that's very exciting.
So that is good.
Just as an aside, I'm guessing the answer is no, or you don't know. Were there female antiquarians?
Not really. There's one or two. There was a woman in the 18th century, I think, called Elizabeth Elstob, who was about the only prominent female woman antiquarian at the time, and the sort of 17th, 18th century kind of the peaks of antiquarianism.
Mm-hmm.
There's also another woman called Dorothy Currer Richardson, who was a pretty big collector, because that was the other thing with antiquarians, they were big collectors, big like museums and then libraries and things.
Mm-hmm.
Another woman actually in Leeds called Elizabeth Hastings, who was someone who corresponded with the guy who we're going to get on to talk about, Ralph Thoresby, who was like the first Leeds antiquarian. But really, they're few and very few and far between. It was a very, as you can imagine, it was like the image you were talking about, very much kind of white, male, middle-aged, middle-class, to a certain extent, or at least elite occupation.
Yeah, pursuit. Interesting. So. Okay, so just let's go for it.
Yeah, so I am the first Leeds antiquarian was this guy Ralph Thoresby, who people may or may not have heard of, probably have heard of.
There's a lot of things named after Thoresby,
aren't there? Yeah. The Thoresby Society,
The school, there's all sorts.
And he lived 1658 to 1725, and he was primarily a merchant. He inherited his father's business.
Mm-hmm.
But he also inherited his father's love of old things, particularly old coins, and his father had a sort of mini museum which Ralph inherited, and that was his real love. So he took his inherited wealth and kind of poured it into his quite obsessive pursuit of trinkets and manuscripts and things. But he did produce something in the end of it. He produced one of these, well, effectively one of these county histories, but it was just of Leeds. It was called The Ducatus Leodiensis. It was published in 1715.
Yep.
And the Ducatus, for the most part, is a... it's a reasonable... I mean, it's something that gets referred to all the time. People are always referring. I'm sure you come across... I've seen it so many times. Yeah, exactly.
And the Leeds Central Library have got... I mean, there's like different iterations of it, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. We've got 100 different copies of it. We're always getting donated and cut more copies of it as well.
Oh, I don't know if you've got this.
By well-meaning members of the public, but...
Yes, I have seen it many times.
And it's always like anything that you read about local history always refers back to Thoresby. But it's not the sort of book that you really in the modern day you sit down and read from cover to cover. I have read it.
I've read some of it.
And it is interesting, particularly the kind of the first sort of bit of it where he goes... He effectively goes street by street around Leeds in his own time and talks about what's there now and what was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of history part of it. And it is interesting, but a lot of it is, you know, let's be honest, a lot of it is quite dull. There's a lot of stuff in there about pedigrees of, like, elite families. Yeah.
I never understood those bits.
Well, this is part of, I've been sort of reading about this. Okay. This is part of, the whole idea of these county histories was to kind of glorify the region that you were living in, and part of that was to play up the lineage, the length of time that these families had been around for, trace their lineages back to various, you know, worthies, but also it was a way of getting subscription from those people that would then pay for the publication of the book. A large part of what antiquarians were interested in was kind of genealogy, was kind of tracing these elite family lineages back as far back as they could, but it's not interesting to read, really. It's kind of dull. But towards the end of the book, Thoresby he catalogues all the items in his museum that he has, which was on Kerrgate, where the Superdrug is in Leeds, on Kerrgate. There's a blue plaque.
Kerrgate is the oldest street in Leeds,
And this museum, which was pretty famous in its own time, people would come from miles around to see it. He writes in his diary, I think at one point, about people coming in from Ireland to look at it.
Wow.
And Thoresby would correspond, communicate and visit with all the other sort of big names in his time, big name antiquarians, people like Hans Sloane, whose own museum collection went on to form the basis of the British Museum and the British Library. His Thoresby Museum was kind of quite a big deal, so he catalogues at the end of the Ducatus all the things in it. But even, and I went through it all like yesterday, like every single page of it, and it's, I was doing that thing with my finger because I was clicking through. I had, there were JPEGs on the screen, yeah. So that was me clicking. Again, a lot of it's quite dull because a lot of it's just lists of coins. He loved coins. He's really, all these antiquarians were into coins. Not to disparage coin collecting, but it's not. I'm not that into.
He's right, Bob.
Yeah, yeah, kind of. In terms of the, you know, out of all the things you could be interested in about the past, coins.
Sorry
is,
if you collect coins, yeah. Anyone listening.
And my wife's about to start going metal detecting, so she's probably going to get really into coins.
That is quite cool, though.
Yeah.
It's a fine line.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah. She won't publish it all in a long, boring catalogue.
Like, say that now.
She'll be listening to it.
She'll be a modern antiquarian.
Modern antiquarian, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or. But then, after all of that stuff, he gets into the really interesting stuff because he gets into this thing that he calls his rarities. And this is where it gets really interesting because he lists all the stuff he has in his museum, mm-hmm. That is unique and weird and odd. Mm. So, first of all, he talks about animal stuff that he's got. I mean, some of this isn't that odd, but a couple of examples. He has the foot of a great white bear.
Of course.
Yeah, the skeleton of a greyhound.
Essential.
A chicken with four legs. I don't know. I don't know. I presume it wasn't alive. It was...
probably not.
Well, it's weird because the greyhound, he specifies that it's a skeleton, but it doesn't with the chicken. So. Okay. And then a young cat with 6 feet and two tails, having two distinct bodies from the mid-back. So that's, imagine people coming round and show this stuff off. A prodigious tooth of an elephant, which is 11 inches in circumference. The bones of this creature are frequently exposed as human, he says, and this accordingly passed as a giant's tooth, but is, in fact, one of the grinders of an elephant.
Right.
I've never heard them referred to as grinders. That's a technical term for elephant tooth.
No.
And then he also provides a little anecdote of an account of a swarm of dragonflies in Lincolnshire in 1699, which went with such force that persons were forced to turn their backs of them. Which is...
A swarm of dragonflies?
Yeah. I think that's what he says. It's just after a bit where he lists a load of dragonflies he's got, and then he tells this anecdote about this swarm. So I assumed it was but I don't really know anything about the natural world, so...
Are you likely to get dragonflies?
No, I'm like one of these old antiquarians, just stay inside in my manuscripts. Are you likely to get dragonflies in Lincolnshire?
We do get dragonflies, don't we?
Oh, right, so maybe it is. A swarm? Yeah, it's with such force,
I guess,
you have to turn your back on.
What is class as a swarm? Three? Three plus? Okay.
And it's not that there were so many of them they had to go inside to hide from, they just had to turn their backs
back
on them.
So yeah, maybe it is like three or five.
Yeah. So there's the animal stuff, but then it gets into the human stuff.
Ooh.
And that's where it's really good. So there's various human bones.
Yeah.
I mean, some of it's a bit too... I mean, yeah, you know, we apply modern sensibilities to some of this stuff. There's some stuff that I just wouldn't want to... There's stuff to do with children, basically, which I wouldn't want to But then there's also other human bones and stuff. He describes owning a part of a sort of mummy found at or near Chester. A sort of mummy. So, yeah. There's lots of stones and balls that have been, in his words, voided from people, including some an inch and a half long, others rounder than rugged, from the penis of an aged minister and sent me by his executioner.
Whoa!
Yeah.
I hate that so much.
Yeah, I know, it's horrible. And that's not, I mean, there's more. There's stuff about balls that have been voided from people via their stools, as he says.
What are people doing?
I don't know. Well, I mean, no doubt their diets and things are pretty bad.
Absolutely.
I just thought it was extraordinary that he actually used the word penis. I had to kind of look at it again, and even then I wasn't sure, because you know this sort of handwriting the letters sometimes are a bit weird, and I thought, well, maybe I'm just misreading it, but he used the same word again later on when an entirely different bit of the catalogue, he starts going on again about all these balls that have been voided from penises and other orifices, so he's obviously something that he was really interested in.
Great.
And it's definitely that. It's definitely using that word.
Wow,
that was really interesting.
That is interesting.
supposed horns that have been cut from the toes of Dr. Rowful of Leeds, half an inch thick at the root and 2 inches long.
Ew. Okay. Yeah.
A toothbrush from Mecca, which is not human, but okay. It comes in the human section. Yes, a large Prussian boot of red leather for a very lusty man.
That's my favourite so far.
Yeah.
Just one.
Yeah.
Okay.
The hand and arm of the Marquis of Montrose.
Just... They're attached to each other, or just...
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I presume so.
Yeah. Yeah. Could be one side arm, one side hand.
Yeah, I don't know. The Marquis of Montrose is apparently a figure of some repute in the 17th century, right. Something to do with the English Civil War.
Okay.
So it was obviously something that, like, a prized possession. Yeah. So, yeah, but what configuration they took, I don't know. But then he also talked about a guy called Edmund Preston of Leeds, the noted butcher, thought to be the best footman in England.
Oh.
And again, he obviously really likes his story because he tells it twice at different points in the catalogue.
Oh.
And the second time he tells it, Edmund Preston, the noted butcher, is not just the best footman in England, he's the best footman in Europe at that point.
Wow.
Apparently, gentlemen come to see him run from as far away as Newcastle, Chester, and London.
Mm-hmm.
He could run around Chapel Town Moor twice in 14 minutes. 4 miles, apparently, that is.
That is bullshit. He can't.
Well, if he could do it, he couldn't do it for very long because the reason why he's mentioned in his catalogue, in his museum, is that he has Thoresby owned the fatal stick cut out of the body of Edmund Preston, the noted butcher, which it caused the wound that he died by, and he received this after skipping over a hedge after some strayed sheep. So,
ooh, that's grim.
That is grim, isn't it? Yeah.
We've obviously gone a bit too fast.
He was skipping as well, which is a
nice bucolic
image. I mean, some of this stuff is the sort of stuff you would find in a museum today.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of it is beyond. I mean, you wouldn't keep that, would you?
It's kind of fun because it's so specific.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so specific.
It is, isn't it? And just a bit grim.
Because,
again, people would come round and they'd be like, oh, yeah, this is the stick that was... You know that Edmund Preston, the noted butcher? The best footman in Europe.
It ran really fast.
Yeah.
And skipped over it.
This is the stick that he died from. So those are his rarities. But then he goes on. He has his whole other section,
mm-hmm.
which he calls anecdotes in the manner of Dr. Plot, unusual accidents that have attended some persons. And Dr. Plot was another antiquarian who wrote a book about some county. I can't remember which one. And the thing that always gets said about this section of Thoresby's Decartus is that it's regrettable. That's the word that people often use when they're writing about it. It's regrettable that he took this example from Dr. Plot and included these bizarre anecdotes.
Okay.
But I actually, after reading them, I actually think they're really fascinating, both as really just a social history, because for probably the only part of the whole book, he includes names of plenty of people living in Leeds who these incidents occurred to.
Mm.
And they're probably, for the most part, not the sort of elites that he mentions in the rest of the book, the people who turn up in these pedigrees and things. Mm. And also, you can kind of read between the lines in some of it and pick out little bits and pieces of again, sort of social history that are not really written about at all in the rest of the book, particularly of kind of everyday life. So there's a bit where he talks about, in these anecdotes, he talks about, if I can find it in my notes, and it's quite, well, it's not really topical anymore, but it would have been topical a few years ago. In December 1675, an epidemic of distemper which struck Leeds, a severe cold and violent cough that affected all manners of people and that so universally that it was almost impossible to hear distinctly an entire sentence of a sermon in the parish church.
Wow.
So stuff like that is really interesting because that gives you a real sense. It's quite visceral and brings us times to life, really, in a way that the rest of the book kind of doesn't always. But there's some others as well. I mean, some of them are absolutely extraordinary. There's a lot of the first page of it is about conjoined twins, really. Lots of instances of conjoined twins that Thorsby's either been told about or has seen himself.
Mm.
He also tells a story about having seen a wild Irishman who had been exhibited in Leeds, who had thighs as hairy as a satyr, if I'm saying that correctly. Oh. And he also goes on to say, what was most wonderful of all, as King Charles said, to whom many of the nobility it was shown, which is an interesting use of language, was the most prodigious kind of a bag handing down betwixt the thighs without the mark of either sex in it. Which is, I mean, these days, again, if we apply modern sensibilities to these, we would recognise these human beings,
yes,
and they're not figures of fun. What I think is interesting about it is that the fact that these people listening to this catalogue are sort of, you know, I don't know what, it's basically like freak show stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, they're like articles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they are. Yeah. Artifacts in the same way as other stuff is. And also the language he uses, that he refers to it as it, he refers to the person as it, which again is extraordinary, really. The other thing I was going to say about Thorsby's language, this goes back to what we're saying about the women antiquarians, is he writes at one point in his diaries, I think, about Elizabeth Elstob, who I was telling about earlier. Mm. He refers to her as being the Saxon nymph.
Whoa.
Which is just, yeah. And I've seen it written that this is actually complimentary language. But,
is it?
Yeah, well, that's what I thought.
I mean, it does sound fun, but also, like, I don't think I would feel complimented by that. Especially
no.
Not. Hmm, that's interesting.
And I saw a separate reference to Elizabeth Elstob. Not, this isn't Thorgrim who said this, but that she was referred to as having something along the lines of having masculine instincts when it comes to antiquarian work, and that
right.
was a kind of way of praising her.
Okay.
The Saxon nymph thing, though, I mean, yeah, maybe it is a kind of complementary thing in its own time, but I think it's notable that, as far as I know, and I'm sure there'll be people who've read much more of Thorsby's diaries than I have, who'll be able to correct me on this, as far as I know, he never refers to any of the male antiquarians that he corresponds with these kinds of nicknames.
Mm.
So I do think there are some interesting uses of language in his
I am going to possibly use that as a band name, though, because it's a really good band name.
Yeah, it is. Really, yeah, I'm surprised somebody hasn't.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Mm.
It does, in Thorsby's own words, though, going on to more of his anecdotes in the manner of Dr. Plot, falls short of the woman who, being surprised with the sight of an ape carrying a red hat on his head, brought forth a child, the head of whereof exactly resembled that of an ape so dressed, and for the rest, like a human body.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether... It's just so bizarre. An ape carrying a red hat on his head. I mean, I get that he's probably seen or heard about a child that's been born with some sort of, birthmark or something. But
yeah.
Where does the ape come into it?
I don't know. Fascinating.
Do you see many apes carrying
red
hats on his head?
Hmm.
So weird. he does. I mean, there's quite a bit of this, but it's most of it's quite fun. He goes. He talks at one point about. What is it? Yeah, he just randomly at one point he just starts talking about how he, in my younger days, either I had not the usual quantity of spittle that others have, or some obstruction in the venting of it. For though I could spit upon some very extraordinary occasions, yet it was a force upon nature. And it's just kind of random. He just, just sort of puts it in.
That's like the definition of like a cool story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, just to interject.
Yeah.
At the time when, well, I suppose, so this is in Decartus Leodiensis.
Yeah.
So when Decartus Leodiensis was first published, just for like people listening that might not know, who were the kinds of people that are reading this? Like, who would be reading these weird anecdotes and being like, yes?
Yeah, that's what I want in my history of... well, people like Thoresby, so sort of middle class and upwards, merchants and gentry and elites, you know, sort of... certainly, it's the sort of book that would have been in the libraries of, you know, like landed gentry or whatever. Whether everyone would have read it, I don't know.
Yeah.
But people... Other antiquarians certainly would, and they're all similar sort of background to Thoresby, sort of professionals. There's always a lot of lawyers and clerics and people like that. So, yeah, whether or not that is the sort of material they were wanting to find, and it's entirely possible a lot of people thought this material was in bad taste, really.
Mm.
Certainly, about 100 years after the book came out, there was a second edition released by another antiquarian called Thomas Dunham Whittaker.
Yeah.
And he in this section, in his edition of the Decartus, he adds a little footnote where he says that if it wasn't for the fact that there is a rage in the current day for basically having a go at editors if they take material out of books, I would have just kept this bit out entirely. But I'm kind of obliged to keep it in because otherwise people will... you know, tell me I've edited the book badly. Which is also, you know, kind of interesting to in a lot of current arguments about censorship.
Absolutely.
Removing materials from books. So it certainly gives the impression that, I mean, 100 years can be a long time in terms of social attitudes and stuff, and it might be that 100 years after Thoresby, attitudes had become a lot less progressive, if that's the right word. I don't know, probably not. It might be that in Thoresby's own time, people found this sort of material to be an acceptable part of the antiquarian discourse. I'm not 100% sure. Certainly this Dr. Plot, who was another prominent antiquarian, had a similar anecdote.
Yeah.
So I honestly don't really know, but it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear any more of those?
Of course I do.
Well, there's quite a few. I'll try and pick out. So there was a guy who, Reverend James Blackbeard, who was said to have gout so bad that he lost the use of his hands and had his joints most grievously knotted, from which tumours he excluded a gritty kind of substance, not unlike chalk stones.
Oh my God, I don't want to hear it now. Now, carry on.
There's not really any more like that. Oh, apart from the wife of... Well, it just says GT, two initials, so I don't know who that was. Being hot with harvest work, drunk of the first water she came to, though it was covered with a green slime, wherein was probably the spawn of frogs, wherewith she was supposed to be impregnated, having after some time a most cruel gnawing and corroding in her body, of which she died, but her relations refused to have her dissected. He then goes on to say that frogs and certain reptile may be bred in human bodies is probable. I have heard from good hands of a man that vomited two kittlings, which was supposed to proceed from his eating unwashed salads with the sperm upon it.
Okay.
But the strangest instance is that of a servant maid mentioned, and then he mentions some other ancient writer, who voided at the mouth two great toads and four small ones with two small lizards all alive.
So that sounds like, I don't think I've talked about it on the podcast yet, but I have written a talk about it.
Mm.
So there's a book in Leeds Central Library called MSS on Witches and Witchcraft. I have read some newspaper articles that are stuck in the back on a couple of occasions, but the actual book is written by, well, I guess like a 1930s/40s antiquarian, Edwin Hick.
Yes.
And he'd collected weird stuff, including a lot of stuff about witchcraft, along with like all sorts of things like sundials and coins.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were rudely interrupted because my card was full, but it's actually not full at all. So we're just jumping back in, and I've had to download an app on my phone to record because that's how professional I am. So I'll go back to my point that I was making. So I was going to say was it reminds me of this MSS on Witches and Witchcraft by Edwin Hick, who was sort of like a more modern day, I guess, antiquarian, a bit of a collector and a bit of a fanatic and seemed like a pretty obsessive person that donated a load of his stuff, I guess, to the libraries upon his death in 1948. So anyway, MSS on Witches and Witchcraft is basically a transcription of all these old witch trial documents, and with all the weird bits and bobs in it, and like animals and things coming out of people's mouths and various other things. Yeah. It's sort of described in this way in these like 17th novels. So it's things like shoving underneath the arm, or like something came out of the mouth, or it's all sorts of chickens in it. Anyway, that's probably such a massive come down after being like 15 minutes of me to record without my dictaphone. Anyway, that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
And it also, I suppose it's quite a good equivalent of like a, I say modern day because I guess it's like 20th century.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, we can carry on with your with your story.
Well, there's only a few more that falls. I mean, there are lots more, but there's only a few more that are probably worth picking out. I would encourage people to go and look at the original book themselves. And also, the break made me realise that I should probably say that I don't only think that Thorsby and his work is worth looking at to sort of laugh at it. I wouldn't be interested in this stuff if I didn't think that there was something else to it than just these silly stories at the end.
Mm.
But this is the least dry of them.
For silliness.
Yes.
So definitely. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So he tells a story about a Dr. Wastel or Wastel of Wakefield, a useful physician, who was going up a pair of stairs on the 2nd of October 1679. He's very specific about that. As he was smoking a pipe of tobacco, he unhappily stuck the end of the pipe so fast into his throat that it could not be got out. He was not able to speak one word, but wrote his mind and died shortly after. When the grave was lately opened, and he doesn't say why on earth they were opening the grave, but when the grave was lately opened, the pipe's end was found in his skull.
Oh my God.
But that raises questions. Like, why, when Thor's writing this book 35 years after this happened, why were they opening this gentleman's grave?
That's a great story though.
And there's another one about death. I quite like this. I mean, it's not particularly gruesome, it's just a bit uncanny. He tells the story of the grandfather of the mayor of Leeds. He doesn't say if it was the mayor of Leeds at the time he was writing or just at the time he was told this story, because he was told by another relative. The grandfather of the mayor of Leeds was 88. Asked his servant what time it was. The servant replied it was 6 p.m. And the grandfather said, "I shall die at 9 p.m. And he did.
great timekeeping.
Yeah, he just died at 9 p.m. The final one and this one again, I think similar to sort of what we were saying about some of the language and stuff the thing about the epidemic being quite interesting if you kind of read between the lines, or it gives you some flavour of the times. He tells a story about Mrs. Elizabeth Rhodes, who lived in Morley, who was inexplicably seized with a distemper that deprived her of her speech. And although she recovered, it frequently returned, especially upon any sudden accident. And he said that when she was suffering from this distemper, the only time she would speak would be if a Bible was open before her. But as soon as it was closed, she was as mute as before.
Oh.
And Thorley tells the story quite objectively. But his editor, Whittaker, who we mentioned earlier, 100 years later, he has a little footnote. Not just about Elizabeth Rhodes, it's about other people who suffered from similar maladies. And he says that the people were either, he says something like, "Oh, this is just nonsense," fanatics, or what's the word for people who feign illnesses?
Like a hypochondriac?
Yeah, hypochondriacs. Fanatics are hypochondriacs. He's very dismissive of it. But really, I mean, I was reading something not so long ago on the Guardian's website, an article from a few years ago about people suffering, obviously, from these kind of psychological related,
yeah,
you know, illnesses that cause things like sleep. You know what I mean? You know.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Just fall asleep for like 6 months or whatever, yeah, that sort of thing. There's probably a more sensitive way of putting it than I just did. But, you know, these psychological related sort of trauma related illnesses. Yeah. And it sounds as though this is probably what Elizabeth Rhodes was suffering
from. Definitely.
Particularly as it returns upon any sudden accident.
Mm.
And that sort of detail, that kind of flavour of somebody's life and the times is I think really interesting. And again, that's not the sort of material you really get in the rest of the
decanter. Yeah, that's interesting.
So that's Thoresby and his anecdotes in the manner of Dr. Plot.
Yeah.
There are lots more of them, so I would encourage people to go and read them.
Yeah, definitely. There's enough copies.
Yeah, there are enough copies. Yeah,
in the Central Library.
Yeah, there's a copy in my local library. Actually, some of the local libraries do have copies there. But Thoresby, one of the people that he was just in the similar vein, so I'll just go straight into this. One of Thoresby's friends was a man called John Lucas, who was a schoolmaster who lived in Leeds, although he was actually from Lancashire, and he was something of an antiquarian himself as well. He wrote a history of the parish of Wharton in Lancashire, where he was born.
Mm.
But he also kept a memoranda book, which we have a copy of at the Central Library, and it's the original manuscript of this book, which is a fantastic artefact.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells various stories in there, because his memoranda book is basically like a diary, isn't it? And he records national events, but he also records some local events. Not as many local events as you might want, but he tells some stories, like one which is in the similar vein to the Thoresby stuff. On 18th of April 1715, one John Sim of Mabgate died very suddenly about 5 o'clock in the evening, was buried the next day, and on Wednesday at about 10 in the morning, some person supposing that they heard him groan in his coffin, the grave was immediately opened and he taken up, but no symptoms of life appeared in him, and he was buried again the same day in the evening. So
creepy.
Yeah, I don't know.
How close was this person to the grave to hear them?
To hear this groaning, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Not as good as some of the Thoresby stories.
I like that one.
Yeah.
That's very morbid.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's just quite frightening, isn't it, the idea that someone might actually have been buried alive.
Mm, definitely.
Yeah. Let's hope that wasn't his fate.
Yeah, I hope not.
So, Lucas, who wrote that story, he also worked with another schoolmaster called Thomas Wilson, who I know you've heard of, no doubt.
Yes.
And he was also an antiquarian. He was a master transcriber. A lot of these antiquarians would employ people to transcribe out old documents because they couldn't get access to the originals very easily. So they'd send someone like Thomas Wilson out, who was of a slightly lower social standing, because he was a schoolmaster, not like a professional or lived off money like Thoresby did.
Mm.
So Wilson would go around transcribing all these old documents. He had a huge collection of his own, and he wrote various bits and pieces that we've got at the Central Library. But he worked with Lucas. One of the copies of the Decartus that we have at the Central Library has been annotated by this Thomas Wilson. So he's written all these marginal notes, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And although he was reputedly a fan is the wrong word, and follower is also the wrong word, but an admirer of Thoresby and his work.
Yeah.
Some of the notes that he makes in the Decartus, particularly when it comes to the museum, are quite funny. So he goes through all the catalogue stuff, and because after Thoresby's death, his museum was kind of dispersed, but a lot of it was found by Wilson in a garret in Chapel Allerton, I think. And a lot of it was in pretty poor condition, but Wilson went through it all, and he went through the catalogue and kind of cross-referenced them and write his opinions of the stuff that he found. And he's really scathing. A lot of this stuff that Thorsby collects out of these ancient artifacts here. Wilson, looking at it, I don't know, more objectively, more sceptically, describes it as being, in one case, a childish stuff of no value. He describes another lot of stuff as being all childish baubles that he threw away after he found them.
Childish baubles.
I know. But then most damningly, he finds this lance, and I think it's a stone or a horn that Thorsby writes about. And he says, as to the lance and stone, they were found, but they were modern and childish. And then he says, an antiquarian like Mr. T is a credulous ape.
So how? When was this?
This was in like the 1740s, I think.
Isn't that film. Long?
No, it's not that long. It's not that long after. Whether Wilson had, I don't know, had the chance to read more, like much more research had been done into ancient artifacts in the time between, or Wilson had a better eye for stuff, or actually Wilson was wrong. I don't know. But this, considering how much his own work builds on Thorsby's research, to this term credulous ape is just shocking.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully it wasn't an ape wearing a red hat.
Then, then you're in trouble.
And then Wilson, in turn, was pretty much slagged off. We mentioned this Thomas Dunham a few times. He was this guy about 100 years after Thorsby, who edited the second edition of Thorsby's Ducatus. He actually married into the Thorsby family. He married someone, Lucy Thursby, I think, by that point they were calling her. The family. And he wrote a short biography of Wilson in another book called Biographia Leodiensis, and he's very, very, very critical of Wilson. He says that he was a man not easy to be described. He said he was dull, usefully laborious in gleaning after his master Thorsby, but like other men of inferior education, who by pertinacious industry have attained to considerable knowledge, he was sullen and disappointed and envious. He says that he's referring to the notes that Wilson makes in the Ducatus, and presumably he's thinking of this credulous ape one. He says he has treated his, Thorsby's, memory with all the contumely, I don't know what that means, but with all the contumely, which low-bred petulance and malice could devise. So he's incredibly critical of Wilson.
Wow.
But Whitaker was an odd character, though, because in another book that he wrote called Loidus and Elmet, which was kind of basically just like a sequel to the Ducatus, there's a very famous or infamous passage in that when he's talking about the Leeds Library, you know, the private library in the centre, in which he basically implies that organisations like the Leeds Library have expanded access to information and education, and in doing so they have allowed people such as the manufacturer, the artisan, or the mechanic to gain access to knowledge and information, which really should have been the preserve of the kind of gentleman antiquarians.
Yes, that we've of been course. Talking Don't about. Let everyone have it, the same knowledge. That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
So we should just preface that. We must have talked about it before on the podcast, but the Leeds Central Library, which is still there today, which is where we both work, mostly, is the public library, and then it's very confusing if you don't know what it is. But then the Leeds Library is a subscription library, and it is actually older than the public library, so it's 1760s,
something like that. Yeah,
1760s. Yeah, and it's still there as a subscription library. So just to differentiate between the two,
yeah.
And the Thorsby Society is based in the Leeds Library subscription library, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Just for some context.
Yeah, and if you've never been, there. It's well worth going.
It certainly is. It's lovely.
Yeah.
yes.
So yeah, so that's Whitaker's perspective. No. It's possibly a perspective that was shared by a lot of these antiquarians back to Thorsby's age and earlier, that this work was a gentleman's pursuit. It wasn't for So Thomas Wilson is a an interesting figure in that respect, because he was much more, I suppose, working class. I don't know if that's quite how you would, or he would have described himself, being a schoolmaster, but he wasn't at the social class of a Thorsby or a Whitaker at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's somebody who deserves or warrants a lot more attention
really. I know my colleague Phil, who we mentioned earlier, he's doing a lot of work into Wilson and his life.
Yeah.
Because he was an incredibly prolific transcriber and writer.
And, like, if anyone's done transcribing, oh, my God, it's so difficult and laborious.
Yeah.
I've done quite a bit, and it's a lot.
Yeah, and Wilson did reams and reams of it, and it all in really, like, ornate handwriting. Various different handwritings as well, depending on what he was writing.
That's how I wrote the talk about the MSS on witches and witchcraft, so that's... I transcribed it from the handwritten, from handwritten that he'd handwritten from whatever document he'd found it from. And I first got it and I was so excited. And then I'd say like 5 pages in, I was like, why am I doing this? it's so difficult.
Yeah.
Did get into it and like I managed to sort of like sift through quite a bit of it and find the bits that were interesting. But once you sort of, I'm just going to move the phone because the cat is back again. The curse. Oh, here he comes. So it's very difficult. And it takes a while to get into as well.
Yeah.
So like that's not an easy job for someone who is considered, you know, like not as worthy as these antiquarians, I suppose.
Yeah, quite. And he's doing the sort of grunt work, one of a better term, that these people then rely on. Kind of going out and finding these documents and making these copies that they can then use as the basis for these books.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see what kind of stuff Phil finds out.
Yeah.
About him. He's staying with me.
Hopefully Phil in particular is writing an article about Thomas Wilson for the Thoresby Society, a volume that's hopefully coming out in a few years to mark the 300th anniversary of Thoresby's death, I think, in 2025.
Yeah.
So hopefully he'll have found out plenty about Wilson by then.
Yeah. Well, that was fascinating.
Yeah.
You got anything that you want to add?
Well.
About antiquarians.
Yeah, there's one more antiquarian.
Ooh, okay.
Which kind of completes this. And this is this has been a very, very top. It's not even been a potted history, really, as it's so much, but it's been a focus on Thoresby.
Okay.
But this sort of lineage of these Leeds antiquarians, they're all kind of connected to one another, or they all kind of build on each other's work. And the kind of last person in this sequence is this guy, William Boyne, who produced what is almost certainly one of the most spectacular and genuine treasures that the Central Library has, that the city of Leeds has, really.
Yeah, whenever I think of the Boyne, I just think of how big it is and how heavy it is to carry.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I suppose you say about all these antiquarian works, like the Ducatus, they're big books,
aren't they?
I don't know what size they are technically, like folio, but what that is in terms of dimensions, I don't know.
Okay, let's have a think about, so I'm about 5'4" and they come maybe up to my thigh and they're quite thick.
Yeah, they're always very thick and like really like heavily bound. But the Boyne is even worse because basically William Boyne, he took Thoresby's volume of the Ducatus and Whitaker's Lloydus and Elmet, and he expanded them out from the two original very sizable volumes to seven, I think it is. Seven or eight volumes of all of the same huge, thick size.
Yeah.
And he did that by, he acquired various documents, particularly illustrations that would literally illustrate the things that had been talked about in the book, and he'd insert them into the pages of the original books in a process known as Grangerizing, isn't it? Grangerization.
Yeah.
He Grangerized the books.
Yes.
and he produced these really spectacular volumes, and obviously there's only one copy of this whole set. It's Boyne's History of Leeds, and we have it at the Central Library. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to have it digitised soon.
That's so exciting. So, I mean, the reason why I've seen it quite a lot was from... Someone asked for some pictures from it for a book a few years ago, which I managed to get for them from it. But then we also, at one point, we did, like... Didn't we do like a collaborative like talk thing? And we each had a volume, and I can't remember which volume was mine.
No.
They all look the same from the outside.
Yeah,
but yeah, we all sort of took one and
that had a good look through it to try and describe it to people that visited.
Yeah, that worked really. That was worked really well.
Yeah, it did.
Because they rarely get a chance to see it because it's obviously in a storeroom, securely locked away, and we don't get out very often because it's huge and very heavy, hard to carry.
Yeah,
and people just don't get a chance to see them, but they're really well worth seeing.
Yeah.
But the thing that's really, really interesting about Boyne, I think, is that, like Thoresby, he inherited wealth, but his father was a tobacco importer and merchant, a finisher.
Mm-hmm.
And when Boyne's father died, Boyne inherited the business and the wealth. But he wasn't, like Thoresby again, he wasn't interested in the business. What he was interested in, funny enough, was coins. Again, he wrote several books or put together these published collections of old coins. But he had broader antiquarian interests, like Thoresby as well. So he inherited all this wealth, and he built a massive home in Headingley, a massive house called the Woodlands, I think, which is pretty much where there's a row of, it's a long time since I've been to Headingley, but there's a row of shops where, like, is it Salvo's?
I know what you mean.
Round there. But he didn't live there for very long because he started to get increasingly dissatisfied with the direction that Leeds and Headingley were taking. It was getting much too urbanised and industrial for him. So he left. He moved to, I think, Paris at first and then Florence and never returned to Leeds. But in that time, he continued collecting material about Leeds, and that's what was put together into this book, into these series of books, which has been described by quite well-known, notorious librarian, J.A. Symington, who was Lord Brotherton's personal librarian. He's been a masterpiece of antiquarian workmanship, the most fitting monument the city can boast of, which it is. But the other side to this is the source of the Boyne family's wealth, which is the tobacco importing. And Boyne's father, his name I think was Thomas, he built a house for the Boyne family, which is now on the University of Leeds campus, which when he built it, he named it after the place that the tobacco they imported came from, which was Virginia. Mm. And this is the early 19th century. So this is obviously before the American Civil War, before the emancipation of enslaved people in the American South. So that enslaved people's labour was the source of the Boyne family wealth. And this is the same wealth that then went into allowing Boyne to purchase all of these wonderful illustrations and documents and put together this fantastic collection and fantastic book. And that's something that I think always needs to be acknowledged with this thing.
Yeah,
that
definitely.
It's not enough to just say this is a wonderful piece of antiquarian workmanship and that we should be boasting about it. We should also always acknowledge where that wealth came from.
Absolutely.
And in a similar respect, although much less important in terms of the human cost, is that, and this again, this is a thread that goes back to Thoresby, is the way that some of these antiquarians treated some of the documents that came into their possession. So Boyne, for a fact, because he even makes a note about it, one of the things that he's purchased, he writes a little note saying that he had to cut this illustration to make it fit the pages of the thing that he was pasting it into. So instantly you have something whose integrity has been taken away by Boyne in order to make it fit the thing that he wants.
Yeah.
And I read something just the other day about Thoresby, how he received some, he was a really big collector of autographs, which I didn't realise until the other day. And he received these autographs from some other antiquarian, who wrote a letter to him saying that he had cut the autographs off these Tudor era letters just to send to Thoresby.
What?
Yeah. So again, the respect for the integrity of the documents is kind of not what we in the modern era would expect. Similar arguments made about the way that some of these antiquarians would take documents out of their basically out of their context. So they would go to these state these government repositories, and they would take all these really old, like, roll calendar rolls or what have you, these documents, so they could use them for their research. And partly, yeah, they weren't being preserved very well, but we would never these days, we would never accept somebody removing official documents from, like, archives and you know, because they have to be kept in the places that they are.
That's the right way of putting that. That's so interesting, like, just snipping a bit off it.
I think clearly the issue about the source of the Boyne family wealth is the much more important one of these two, but I think both of these two are examples of the kind of hidden costs to some of this antiquarian work, both in terms of, yes, the human cost of where this wealth has come from in the first place to allow these antiquarian collections to be made. Not in all cases, of course, but in some.
Yeah.
But then the other one is on the level of the cost to the documents themselves and all this collecting and acquiring and pasting into books and things. There's not always enough care and attention has been paid to the original documents and their original context.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on. Was that planned?
Sort of, but only in the sense that I wrote two other antiquarians' names down. Okay. I can think about anything to say about them, really.
Okay, that's all right.
Yeah.
So, I think it, that was a good way to end because it's quite a nice roundup to sort of look back on how we view antiquarians now. Obviously you pick. I can see that you picked out the funny weird stories for me, but there is a lot of other context around it.
Yeah.
And as always, I will put links to everything that we talked about in the show notes because you can actually see all these things. You can come and look at them.
Yeah.
If you want to, if you're so inclined. And there's also things like blog posts, and I can put pictures of you know, like anything that we've talked about, like locations and that kind of thing. I can link all those in the show notes as well to give a little bit extra context if you're not able to look at things like in person if you wanted to. Things like the blog posts will have like snippets of pictures of the documents and things like that.
Stuff from the Secret Library.
Yeah, blog. Secret Library. Yeah. Secret Library, I probably link in like every, which is the blog post, the blog for Leeds Central Library local history department. So we'll leave it there for antiquarians, unless there is something that you end with.
You're right, I think that's as good a place as any. I mean, there's loads more, although there isn't, because William Boyne was kind of one of the last of the real antiquarians, because once you get towards the end of the 19th century, and he dies in 1893, this whole discipline gets taken over really by kind of the specialisation of professional historians in universities, and also the emergence of things like the Thoresby Society, so historical and antiquarian societies.
Yes.
So people start coming together to do this thing in a much more organised way than they were 200-300 years before. And that all happens around the time of King. So in a way, he's the last true Leeds antiquarian.
Yeah, and like if anyone's listening that's outside Leeds, if you know any other antiquarians, get in touch and we'll can have a nosy at them as well and see if they're linked up with any of the ones that you've talked about today, which I'm sure they did. They're all sending each other bits and bobs.
Oh yeah, that was one of the things I suppose I didn't say in the definition or introduction towards the start is they form these great networks. They're always all writing to one another and meeting up with one another. So, but again, that's why once you get societies, you don't need to do that. So it kind of it changes the dynamic.
Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And on just like sort of what you've been up to, what you've been watching. If you listened to anything good, have you been anywhere exciting, etc.
I've not been anywhere. Well, I've come here to do this. That's exciting.
Yeah, I should say that Anthony lives really close to me as well. So it's like he's come up the road to record today.
But it's the first time I've come up this far since Hector left nursery. I've not had to walk up this way. So it's the first time I've done it in about 9 months. Come up this far. So, yeah, that was exciting.
Yep. Anything else?
Have I been anywhere else?
Well, just anything else that you've enjoyed recently.
We've been watching, I'm sure, like everybody else, The Last of Us.
Yes, I have too.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
I've not watched the most recent.
No, I haven't watched this week's. I'll not say anything about it. We've only just started watching. We're going to watch.
Yeah, yeah, good point, yeah.
But yeah, it's very good. Definitely like a good way to start the year with TV, I think. I'm really rubbish, I think it's in every episode, if anyone's listened to other episodes, I'm really rubbish at keeping up with series, or I'll come to it, like, several years later than everyone else.
Yeah,
but this one I've kept up with so far, and it's very enjoyable. And along with everyone else, I'm obsessed with Pedro Pascal, like everyone else.
Yeah, I watched the Mandalorian, sort of Star Wars stuff, so... Yeah, good. And I keep forgetting he's...
Yeah, he is in Game of Thrones. Yeah. One of the characters in Game of Thrones was, as well, definitely. I think.
And somehow... It's weird because he was a great character when he was in Game of Thrones. And I think I just didn't know who he was at the time. Like, I didn't know his name. So then I only kind of really became aware of who he was again when he was in Mandalorian.
Yeah.
And now he's in this.
Yeah, as well. Great. Yeah. Yeah, I've also been watching that as well. I went to the cinema the other day to see Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Oh my goodness, it's the cutest thing ever. Everyone should go and watch it. It's very heartwarming. It's a tiny little shell. Absolute legend.
Sounds like something you've always been
interested in. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is quite light for me, really. But it was very, very sweet. And what else? So it was my birthday at the beginning of the year. Happy birthday to me. I haven't recorded a podcast episode this year yet, so the past two that I put out were pre-recorded, so I've not really said, like, Happy New Year, I guess. Even though, what date is it today?
The 28th of February.
It's March tomorrow. So yeah, it was my birthday, and I went away to the Yorkshire Dales, and that was that was lovely. It was very picturesque and gloomy and rainy, so that was really good. But aside from that, just, you know, like, trying to get started with the year, which is now, like, nearly 3 months in. I'm sure there's more to come for the rest of the year, and hopefully we'll have no podcast curses this year, because most episodes something goes wrong, but it already has today because the dictaphone got full, and now we're on this phone app. I don't know what the sound quality is going to be like, but we'll find out. Every episode is a brand new challenge for me, for my non-existent technical skills. So yeah, so thank you so much for sharing your story. It was a pleasure to have you on the podcast, and you'll have to come back again to talk something else. I'm sure you've got something else that you know a lot about, because you know about lots of things.
Yeah, possibly.
Possibly. Have to think about to it. Go through your powers of things.
So visual though, isn't it? You know, even like books and stuff.
You're right. Yeah. You are right. I think there are ways around it.
Yeah.
And especially with links and social media and that kind of thing.
That's true.
I can do teasers, and then people can. Go back and have a look. I'm sure that people do all the time, and I'm sure that everyone looks at all my links. And if you want to send me a message on Instagram or on Twitter, then please do. Both are at No Heathenland. So I'll leave it there. Thank you again, Anthony.
No problem, thank you.
And I'll probably see you in a couple of days or something.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
That was Anthony Ram discussing Leeds Antiquarians. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did recording it. Again, I'm sorry for the glitches, especially near the end where it just turned out to be every few words. But like I said, I didn't want to re-record and lose the initial fun atmosphere of the chat. I know what the issue with the glitching was down to now, so it shouldn't happen again. But then again, as always, there's always some sound issue around here, isn't there? So... just bear with me. Again, like I've said loads of times before, I hope it's endearing by now. As always, links to the items discussed in the episode will be linked in the description wherever you're listening, and you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram. Both are at No Heathen Land, and Anthony can be found on Twitter at Ram, that's RAMMA Library. I have more plans this year for exciting episodes with new people who I don't already know, branching out. So less in-jokes and incessant giggling from me, which will be good for listeners, I assume. So I hope you'll stick with me, and I will see you next time in No Heathen Land.